So to introduce Dr. Dennis Spencer, Dennis is a resident physician at the Lucile Packard Children's Hospital at Stanford University. He's recently been inducted into the Stanford Society of Physician Scholars, joining other physician scientists from across specialties with similar aims to unite scientific theory to their practice of medicine. In this, Dennis has been afforded protected time during residency to continue his research in pediatric infectious diseases. Dennis is originally from Baltimore, and he's a graduate of Morehouse College, Cornell University, MSCP. I'm sure he'll talk more about that. Outside the clinic in the lab, Dennis serves as a co-investigator with the Building the Next Generation of Academic Physicians program. It's called BINGAP. This is an initiative, a national initiative, with the mission to diversify the academic medical workforce. Dr. Spencer also serves as co-PI of the SNMA Physician Researcher Initiative, and he continues to play a key role in terms of managing a multi-year R13 grant from the NIH to support the initiative's workshop during the national conference. The PRI aims to educate SMA members about careers as academic researchers and to establish a network of mentors to help enhance students' research experiences. In doing so, we aim that more underrepresented minorities may be prepared to enter fields that contribute to health combat health disparities by engaging clinical, epidemiological, translational research. So enough of me, and now I'll provide Dr. Dennis Spencer an opportunity to introduce himself and kind of illustrate the background that has led to where he is today. I'll turn it over to Dennis.
Thank you, Ayo, for the introduction. So I'm very pleased to have been invited tonight to speak to everyone kind of about my path, but also more importantly, just this idea during the academic medicine workforce as a physician scientist. Obviously, that's a joint interest between both SNMA and ABSIS, but I think it's great that two organizations are partnering in this effort. Just to back up a little bit, so IO is the 2014-2015 PRI fellow. But the PRI with SNMA has been a work that I've been involved with since 2007. We've been trying to promote this kind of bringing more information and exposure to the SNMA membership to get more people interested in entering an academic career, whether it be through basic sciences or through a teaching route or through any number of ways that you can be an academician as well as a physician. And with that, we've partnered with BINGAP, and this is something that I mentioned in my introduction. But BINGAP, really briefly, I'm actually, maybe later on when we get to the time for open questioning, I'll ask how many of your ABSA members are familiar with BINGAP. But BINGAP has actually partnered with SNMA as well as with ABSA in the past. Your former president, Donna, I'm missing her last name right now, but she had worked on a couple of efforts with BINGAP in the past, and she and I had spoke on a panel together in the past. So it's one of those partners that has happened in the past, kind of faded, but I would love for us to re-establish that connection too. So this opportunity tonight kind of serves as a dual purpose, because BINGAP, again, also is with the same idea of having people have a clear direction for how to proceed towards an academic career. And, you know, with all of us kind of having these similar interests, it just makes sense that we combine forces and resources to hopefully get the best outcome. So a little bit about my research interests. Clinically, I'm interested in pediatrics, so I'm at Stanford's Children's Hospital. I am a huge fan of that demographic, and that's largely where a lot of my service work has come in, has been with working in that group. I've also done some teaching in the past. I've done some curriculum development. I've done a couple of things that kind of speak towards pipeline building. So that's another interest of mine is within that pediatric, adolescent, and undergraduate populations, kind of bridging each person at their respective level towards hopefully a pipeline that would lead towards, you know, some of these very interesting career paths like academic medicine. But I'm also research-wise in terms of basic science and infectious diseases. My PhD that I received from the Rockefeller University was in microbial pathogenesis. I did this work at Rockefeller trying to find a project that had a clinical implication, but really, you know, fed my interest and being interested in really just straight up basic science. So I did a project that looked at the pathogenesis of strep throat. I was able to establish models for studying this disease process. I was able to do some collaboration at Weill Cornell and at New York Presbyterian to work with their ENT department to gather samples during my PhD of kids who were having tonsillectomies. I established an ex vivo and in vivo mechanism platform to be able to look at early stages of colonization, attachment, and look at virulence of this particular pathogen at the level of the palatine tonsil. And we actually showed that the bacteria does something very unique at the palatine tonsil, something different than it does along the other surfaces of the oropharynx. And that was shown with microarray work, showing upregulation of certain virulence factors as it became in the vicinity of the palatine tonsil. So a very clinically relevant question that we were able to follow it using a basic science approach to get some really interesting targets. And when I left it, we were working on utilizing some of what we learned towards hopefully finding a better way of either preventing the disease or at least better understanding why certain kids have it while others won't. So it was very fulfilling. It kind of revigorated my interest in trying to bridge, you know, from the bench to the bedside and reaffirm that this is, you know, a career path I would love to pursue. So that's kind of been where my background has interfaced me with Stanford. As a little plug to my institution, Stanford is really interested in the physician scientist. We're very interested in kind of cultivating the interest, both clinically and research-wise, in our residents. To that end, about a quarter of the residents in my class, for instance, have PhDs. So, I mean, this is a reasonably large class of like 24, 25 individuals, where seven of us have PhDs. I mean, that's quite impressive in any department, and especially within pediatrics. So it kind of shows within my program the dedication towards cultivating that physician-scientist spirit. And even if you aren't going a basic science route, they're really supporting individuals going some more, let's say, traditional routes for their PhD, and that's something we can talk about a little bit later. So that's really just to bring you guys a little bit more information about myself, my interests, and where I am right now. I'm still kind of trying to establish my niche at Stanford now within research. I have a few interests that I'm actively exploring. I'm kind of now moving towards kind of more high throughput bioinformatics work. I'm particularly interested in the gut flora in the microbiome, and being at a place like Stanford where tech is, you know, everywhere, you know, I have a lot of resources that I didn't even know existed at my disposal. So, you know, it's kind of candy, kid in the candy store, and it's more of an issue now. It's like there's so many cool things that I can do, you know, trying to focus on which ones to really throw my head in and, you know, grab onto. So we can talk about all those things later, especially if people have some specific questions on my path. But I do want this to be interesting and useful for people more broadly. So I will turn it back over to Io. We can maybe do some, directed Q&A. And eventually, I imagine he'll open it to the rest of you. So, Io.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Yeah, so I'll go ahead. I'll do a lead-off question here. And then, as Dennis mentioned, we'll turn it over to the audience to really see what questions you guys have. As we all ask questions, if we would just introduce our name and what institution we're from, what level of training and whatnot that we're all at, that would be lovely. I know, like Dennis, I think we're especially fortunate to have you on board on this call as a trainee. I think it's something that both APSA and SMA are actively passionate about to develop the training experiences. With that, how would you say the transition has been for you? I know it seems like a lot of research-oriented training pathways are about like transition between your research years and the clinical years of medical school, and then beyond that, from an MSPP program to a research track like residency.
Okay, so again, I imagine with APSA especially, and I know also some of the SNMA participants, many of you are MD PhDs, and if you're MD PhD or pursue the MPH or other research interests that had you take time off, that transition back is a toughie. For me, my PhD was not at Cornell where I went to med school. It was at a affiliated institution of the Rockefeller University. So I was completely outside of the medical school for 5.5 years during my PhD. So we at Cornell do the break between preclinical and clinical years right after step one, which we take right after the second year. So at that time, we wouldn't have taken any clinical rotations. We would have only have had just the didactic teachings in the classroom. And that was my stopping point before going away to the laboratory. So many programs still have that traditional model, but I do know some are allowing people to do part of third year, doing some clinical work, then taking step one, then leaving. The latter, I think, provides at least you the opportunity before your PhD to have had some exposure to the clinic, maybe got a couple good scores, good grades under your belt, which kind of can take the pressure off for when you return. But for those who were in my boat, it was a rude awakening. Like I said, 5.5 years having been away from medicine, and at Rockefeller, I also took no tests. We had no written tests as a part of our graduate school requirement, so I hadn't even seen a multiple choice test in almost 6 years by the time I took my first shelf. So it was a rough transition. I definitely struggled. And most of us are used to being high achievers. I will say, I had never been in a position where I just felt completely behind and just not on pace with some other classmates as I did when I returned. So I just would say, I'm sure everybody has kind of heard different stories on this in the past, but for someone who, I'll admit, I'm quite confident in general. For someone who's used to being on top of their game at all times, it is unsettling, and it's something to come in knowing that may happen. But then you really just kick in your, dig in your heels and, do what you need to do. I felt like I studied much more than everybody else. It seemed like that semester, that particular rotation. And, it'd probably still be a little rocky if you hadn't taken a test in a while, but, it was something that you get over. And eventually it came easier. My quick little spiel on that would be that it is useful to get some clinical exposure during your PhD. I still don't know how well that prepares you for getting ready for a shelf if you haven't taken a test in a long time. But I do think there's probably some benefit to staying involved, whether it be if you guys have a free what those things called, a free clinic or something like that, where you can be engaged, at least thinking clinically at some point. I do think, despite the fact it takes you away from science, that it probably is a good idea. So I'll put that out there. The transition from MSTP to PSTP, or a research-based program for residency, I found much simpler. You are, especially the fourth year, doing your away rotations, you're doing sub-I's, you're working as an acting intern, and really, that seemed a lot more fluid. I think in part is because you're kind of at the same level as everyone else. Well, you are at the same level at that point, so you don't feel like you're coming from behind. And because you actually have had a kind of rude jarring coming from a PhD back into a clinical program just from that earlier transition, I think that it just seems a lot smoother for us. And you find that the other students who hadn't taken the time off or taken the time away, rather, that they are the ones who find kind of feel less at a firm footing because they haven't had any transition points in the last 4 years. So I actually do think that that'll be a little feather in your hat. In terms of, like, figuring out doing research, like I said, for me, it's been just amazing how well, you know, people have tried to usher me into their laboratories. That is going to be institution-specific. And, you know, I think I'll try to table a little bit of my comments until it comes to, like, maybe how I chose Stanford, maybe. But in terms of, you know, where your program's interests are, if they're interested in really cultivating the physician scientists, then I think they'll make these opportunities available for you early that you can feel like, you know, you can be reintegrated into research quite readily. Obviously, you are first going to be a resident. Some of your first few months, I would not recommend anyone trying to jump in a lab yet. Like, you do need to learn how to be an intern. But, you know, after a few months, getting your feet wet, making sure you understand the rigor and just the taxing of residency, yeah, starting to go to, like, lab meetings, starting to talk to investigators just about newer types of projects that are doable during residency, you know, it's something that is a great thing to get you back within just that mindset. And I would say the final thing I'm going to say here is, many programs do have, especially for people who are on a research track, like a PSTP or just research-based residency, they have seminar programs. They have, like, seminar series or mentor networks to try to keep you engaged in science while you're, you know, fully being a resident. And those, I think, are so kind of ubiquitous because it's good to still be aware of what's happening potentially in your field or what's happening interestingly in science in general. You know, I used to do a lot of like podcasting or reading journals and things in my leisure time, even in like the clinical years in med school. But, you know, you're working close to 80 hours many weeks as an intern. You just don't have that leisure time as much as you used to. So it is refreshing when someone gives you some protected time to go to a seminar and, like, hear a journal club or hear someone talk about career advancement and maybe something new and cool that's happening in science. Because, you know, for most of us who are interested in science, it's just nice to have that interjecting your day from the clinical. You know, it's a nice little bonus. And most programs have that in place, those in a research-based training program. That was quite long-winded, but, you know, that's my thought on the transition, though. Depending on where you go, it's not as stark as it was from the third-year transition. So at least that's one thing to look out for, look forward to.
Sweet. Thank you very much, sir. All right. So after that great answer, let's see if we can expand the conversation a little bit. Do any of the people on the call have any questions that they have ready?
Yeah, I have a call. A question, rather. My name is, I don't know if you can hear me.
Hi, if we can. Thank you, Martha.
Hi, hi, Dennis. My name is Martha. I'm an M1 at UC, University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. We actually met a couple of times as I guess I could say, grew up in Max in Region 9, and we've crossed paths several times. But I have a question about coming in as an MD who was thinking about doing a PhD during her MD years or not. So I initially applied to the MD-PhD program here, but I got into the MD program, and I talked to the PhD program here, and they are willing to have me take some time off from my MD to do a PhD, but several of my mentors have told me that I shouldn't do a PhD. I can still be a physician scientist without it, which I understand. But if I have a strong interest in basic science, would it be a disadvantage not to pursue my PhD and just go straight through medical school and then try to get into a research-intensive residency?
Okay, so thank you for the question. I mean, or at least bringing up that important point. There are definitely many ways to skin a cat, as they say, and a PhD is not necessary for everyone. I'm actually a firm believer in that. You know, having said that, for my interest, I felt I needed a PhD. And the there are a couple ways of looking at that. I'll try to be brief here, but the one thing that, depending on which mentors gave you this advice, that the PhD does give, that is less tangible, I think, for those who don't have a PhD, is it that it gives you a way to approach a question. You know, you may already be good at doing Western blot. You know, I was a tech before I came to med school, and I did amazing Westerns. I felt very proud about, like, my ability to do, like, certain skills. But there's something to be said from being a great trained hand to being a thinker in the scientific method. And yes, the scientific method is something we all learned in middle school, but the way that it comes alive during a PhD and the way that it is further refined during a PhD is something that the rigor of a PhD, the frustrations of a PhD, the failures that you get in a PhD, it kind of is the whole point, in my opinion, of the PhD. Now, what one does from having that better appreciation of the scientific method, you know, I think that it's useful for someone who may wish to run a laboratory. You know, if your mentors are people who are fully engaged in research, but they do it more in a collaborative way from, like, a clinical department, and they are, you know, doing work with the PhDs, they may not appreciate that because that's not the role that they've had to assume. But if this is someone who, you know, is a PI, if this is someone who is, you know, writing the grants and training grad students and other trainees, I do think there's something to be said for having gone through a PhD. But again, that's not, you know, the only reason to go into science or, like, to stay away from a PhD, and if that's not what you want to do. So there's other reasons people can say for getting the PhD, and I would say you can talk to many more people just to get their view on it. But if you don't want to be a PI, if you aren't trying to run and manage a lab and training graduate students, then, yeah, maybe the PhD isn't as necessary. But again, it really, I think, does strengthen how you approach a question. And it also does have some practical, you know, benefit when you're applying for grants. There are some that will say that the PhD kind of has an implicit level of authority that you have versus your MD counterpart. And for equivocal type of grants, if you have a similar score, the PhD may give you a little bump of confidence more than someone else. And, you know, as they're being very judicious, you can say, with their funding, you know, that might be a useful thing down the line. But, again, there are other funding streams that are specifically for the physician. Not as many, to be honest. But there is that particular view of it, too, though, where the PhD might help you from a funding standpoint. So there's a lot of considerations. I think that, you know, to further look at your case and what would be your interest and your trajectory in seeing if a PhD is necessary, that'd be something to do on an individual basis. But hopefully that's just useful information broadly for the participants on the call who may be kind of in a similar pivot point. And you're certainly not alone. I've had many people come to me, especially within SNMA, who've attended our Physician Research Initiative to ask about, you know, do I have to do a PhD? What about an NPH? What about doing a year and working at the clinical translational skills institutions? You know, I think all of these are great paths depending on what you want to do. If you want to do more epidemiological populations-based work, the NPH just makes a lot more sense. If you're interested in stats that you can use towards, like, looking at your effectiveness with an intervention or something that you may be doing clinically, but just trying to keep a scholarly component to it, you know, the NPH, I think, is very useful. These clinical skills and translational institutions often have a clinical master's that provide you opportunities to learn about creating clinical trials and doing certain other more clinically based work, and I think that they're far more directed than a PhD would be, so I think in some cases that's more indicated. So there are many ways to skin a cat, and I would encourage you to not just listen to one naysayer, but get as broad of a base of people who are giving you this advice as possible, and look at what they're doing. And if they're doing something that you want to do, you know, then maybe they're more credible. But if they aren't even doing what you're doing, they may be a little skewed based on biases that, you know, have nothing to do with, you know, what it is you're trying to do. So that's my thoughts on that. Again, I'm trying to wrap a lot into that response there, but it's a conversation many people have had. I've had this with a lot of people, so certainly don't feel like you're alone trying to figure that out.
Thank you very much, both for Martha and for Dennis, for that great question and answer. I know one question, if there are no follow-ups, that came in through the chat is from Juan Franco. He is from Temple University School of Medicine. He is an SMA member on the Diversity Research Committee. His question, I'll read it verbatim here. For middle and high school students attending school in urban neighborhoods that are severely underfunded, what suggestions and or recommendations would you give these kids and adolescents that are interested in becoming physicians, that are interested in research? These are students that, due to structural restrictions, are not able to take any higher math or science courses than those required by the school district, creating an obstacle for them when starting their college careers and transitioning into classrooms that present higher level math and sciences that are hence like pre-med recs and for math and science majors. So if you have any thoughts on this.
That's awesome. I mean, and it's an awesome question because that's one of my passions is pipeline programming and helping people be exposed, especially at those younger ages. So, I mean, what can you advice you can give them? I mean, if you're even an opportunity where they're asking you, you've already kind of won the game, it seems, because the reality is most people don't even at that age even know of what is possible, especially if they're in a resource-deprived area. So I think I want to take this from the perspective of what we should be doing, because for them, they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what's out there, so you can't blame them for not asking these awesome questions. So I think the more practical thing is more from our vantage points as like med students, as residents, or even as pre-meds, to be honest. Being a part of pipeline programming that are already in place and allowing those programs to be even expanded as best as possible. And recognizing that these pipeline programs, your participation in them, for the most part, just requires your presence. You know, it's nothing that requires a lot of time in most cases. and you know, is something that I feel like behooves many of us to just to do, because someone who maybe not have a mentor or have met a physician of color or a female who is just killing their field, doing amazing work, you know, they may not have those role models. Just you showing up and just, you know, telling your story and just saying hi, you know, not having anything formally created can do be a big thing. So I always push the SMMA type of initiative. So there is the HPREP, the Health Professions, what is it, Recruitment and Exposure Program. That's a high school engagement piece there to engage just by typically something based on your med school, these students who seem to be interested, and just exposing them to, like, hey, there's this thing called a physician assistant. There's this thing called, you know, MSPP. There's a straight-up MD. There's all these other things, just exposing them. But other things is they're always looking for those presenters at middle schools. Like later this week, I'm speaking at a middle school. Say hi, and just to be, you know, a black guy who is, you know, a doctor times two, like saying hello and like letting them know this exists. You know, I'm only going to be there for a few minutes, to be honest. But when people ask me to come, I try to be that person that if I have the time, I'll just show up as needed, because there's nothing else magical you need to do. You know, you don't need to be profound. You just need to be present. And that in itself is, I think, one thing that you can do for those kind of kids, like provide them that exposure. Now, if they're looking specifically for a class, they're already in middle school, but they want to do harder work than what they're getting, getting them connected to, like, Boys and Girls Clubs sometimes will have some tutoring opportunities. Having them involved with local chapters of our respective organizations, LMSA, SMMA, APSA. You know, often there are programs and opportunities they can, like, get a little bit of additional resources that their schools may not provide. But it's harder to change a system. It's harder to change a education district that don't have those resources. And it's really hard to get those kids into classes elsewhere, because often transportation is an issue for these kids as well. So the more that we can engage those type of kids, the more we can inspire them and inspire just through exposure, I think the better off, because that'll at least spark the interest, give them a little taste, and hopefully will further motivate them to, like, continue to explore, continuing to ask more good questions, and hopefully pursue a similar type of career.
Thank you very much for that insightful question, Juan, and the answer, of course.
That was not a classic question. That totally is something I would have told you to ask me, but that's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that one. Are there any follow-up questions or any other questions any of the audience has?
I have an unrelated question, if that's okay.
Absolutely, Peter.
All right, so thank you very much, Dennis, for joining us. My name is Peter Mitwitty. I'm a sixth-year MD-PhD student at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and I was just looking at your LinkedIn and, you know, a little bit about your, you know, what IO wrote about you, and it looks like you were highly involved with, you know, leadership, with service, all these things. And I try to be involved with that stuff, and I hear sometimes from my mentors that, oh, you're doing too much. And so I was going to see if you heard a lot of that. That's my first question. And the follow-up is, are you still planning to be involved with that sort of thing during residency, or are you just going to say, I'm postponing that until I get out and I'm a faculty member and then get re-involved? Or what are your thoughts on that?
More excellent questions, and I really appreciate that one. So what you're doing right now, is hopefully following your interests and your passions. So in terms of, you know, doing leadership roles and people kind of dissuading you, yes, you'll have that. But, I mean, I almost feel like I had to do what I was doing, because I was just so I was so motivated. I was so, I almost felt this sense of obligation to work in many of the work that I had done. Now, in terms of what that mentorship or what those people, advisors are telling you about that is often when you're doing these type of roles, you are doing it in a really altruistic way, selfless way that at the end of the day may be a distraction and slash a detriment to what you're doing. And that is something that you can't allow to happen because you have to still be excellent with your science. You know, I mean, when it's time for you to defend, you know, you'll find out that it is not the time for you to say, oh, well, I was helping people, you know, in an impoverished area. You know, they want to look at the data and look how clean the experiments came across and how strong your argument is. So those things can't falter. But what I also try to do, and I also try to inspire everyone that I mentor on this, is make sure that what you're doing is following your passion, but also that it can be used as a twofer. And that's because, like, we don't have time, like, just free time, really, to do things that may only make you feel good on the inside. Again, showing up at the middle school and speaking for, like, 30 minutes, that's one thing. But when you're really taking on, like, large leadership roles, those are typically going to require a lot more time. So I always try to make sure that when you're doing something that has required a significant amount of time, that it does more than just be something you put on your CV. For example, service. Service is a big part of what I've done in the past. But what you want to make sure that you're doing is, as best as possible, bringing your service to scholarship. So you want to make sure that if you're doing an intervention, like you're meeting a high school group consistently over a few months, providing mentorship and exposure, that you have at your school an expedited IRB to allow you to survey these kids, give demographics on these kids, and then follow them later on after the intervention so that, you know, after it all is said and done, you don't just feel good inside, but you have something that shows an objective measure of benefit, hopefully. And if it wasn't beneficial, you can even then talk about that. You know, when you're writing up a commentary on some of these type of things, or even writing up a full-on report, as opposed to in basic science, negative data is actually even useful when it comes to qualitative and the community engagement type of stuff. So that's something that kind of allows you to keep on your PhD hat. You can be critical about how you're doing things. If you're planning to report on objective measures, you sometimes will even do a better intervention because you're thinking long-term, you know, how am I going to measure this? So you're even more thoughtful, and at the end of the day, it becomes a twofer. And what most PIs and advisors won't argue as much about is something that ends up being an additional publication or something that you can use towards your academic portfolio, because at that point, it's not just a waste of time. You know, publications, reports, things like that is the currency of academic medicine, and if you can bring it to that kind of scholarship, it's not just this kind of frivolous service that many people do poo-poo very, very easily. So that is what I have been doing. Right now, I am holding off a little bit of that as a resident. I'm still kind of peripherally involved in some things that were already put in place earlier, so they were already ongoing, and I'm still making tweaks and still writing papers. But I've not been actively starting any new leadership roles because, yes, I mean, you are less able and have less time as a resident. But, you know, as much as I can, I still do want to try to do things that give me that twofer, because that ultimately helps you in the long run and allows you to follow those passions.
Excellent.
Does that answer your question for you?
That's perfect. Thank you. That's very good.
And I actually have a follow-up question to that. And maybe it's a bit naive, but with regards to service and, like, scholarship, I think obviously in terms of academia from the science side, we hear a lot with regards to, like, intellectual property, things like this. With regards to service initiatives, that could result in, like, not for-profit-like organizations or even, like, for-profit-like organizations,
Are there any things to keep in mind in future years as for academic affiliations, or are they completely unrelated?
So, I'm going to try to respond. You can tell me if I'm actually off or not. The intellectual property that exists in your work in a laboratory, you know, largely stems from the initial investment has been done by the institution or by your PI with a grant that they wrote. So for them, you know, they don't do nothing, something for nothing either. So, I mean, it is kind of like a kind of rip pro quo type of situation where it's really hard to get around that. For the service type of activities I'm referring to, sometimes there is a monetary investment that someone has made, and when you're doing that, of course, you want to make sure that you're, one, indicating, acknowledging that, you know, this has been through the generous support of such and such and such and such. You include that in your acknowledgments. You often will include someone associated with that in the bar, the author bar. That's a whole other conversation, because I do actually have a talk on publication and authorship, because I don't just throw people's name on a publication. That is something you don't want to get in that kind of mess with either. Want to make sure that they're doing something towards that publication, not just giving money. But back there, in terms of eventual affiliations and will that affect you later on, it's far less formal in most cases when it comes to kind of service work. The exception would be like CBPR, community-based participatory research. In those type of projects, there is a lot more of a formal investment by the institution, and there will be some level of intellectual property that will be assigned to whatever comes out of that. And before you even would start writing a publication on that, you would want to clarify anything that they have in place. But for future affiliations and stuff, again, as long as you didn't burn bridges, as long as you acknowledged everybody appropriately when you were doing the initial data assessment and publication, you know, those would not be problems. Again, you just want to make sure you don't make anybody angry at you, especially if you stay in academia. Everybody in academia knows each other. You'll also notice that, too.
Thank you. That's a great answer. Thank you for that. All right. Are there any other questions from any of the callers or attendants?
One more thing I actually wanted to talk about, I'm going to just directly question myself here, is the residency, the research-based residency programs. You know, there are programs in most of the fields of medicine, but some of them far more formalized than others. Historically, internal medicine and pathology have been really hugely into having accelerated and research-tracked programs, trying to bring in more PhDs. Pediatrics has also been a long time field where they've been interested in the physician scientists. There have not been as many formalized programs in the past as you'll find in IM, but they definitely exist. And then definitely there's still like neurology, and then within the surgery specialties, neurosurgery and ortho specifically will have a fair amount of PhDs, and fewer would be in general surgery and urology and like ENT. So one thing for those who are kind of trying to decide what field they want to go into, I think it is important to like know of what opportunities are out there for those who are research-minded, and especially for those who have a PhD. I will talk a little bit about, in pediatrics, our American Board of Pediatrics has a couple of ascribed pathways for the physician scientists. We have the accelerated research pathway and the integrated research pathway. The accelerated, the ARP, accelerated research pathway, essentially allows you to start your fellowship after your second year of residency. So it's accelerated in that you are taking a lot of the elective time that is put into intern and junior year and putting in a lot more of the core requirements that you need to board certification. So it's very jam-packed. You're very focused. But basically, by the fall and spring of your first year, you are preparing your application for fellowship already. So it's quite intense. I was actually on that track initially, and then it became just a little too intense to make that decision and figure out these things so soon. But the caveat with the accelerated research track, research pathway in pediatrics is that you would start fellowship after second year, but you still need a certain number of months of clinical work before you could be board certified. So you would have to actually add another year to your fellowship. So you would be doing a four-year fellowship as opposed to like the more typical three. So that's kind of the trade-off within pediatrics. And within that fourth year, you would have a little bit more clinical responsibility. It'd still be quite minimal, to be honest. But you're hopefully now on a track towards faculty appointment. And that's kind of the whole point of that. They want to get you in fellowship sooner. You're in there longer, but you're on a track that will hopefully land you a permanent position, or at least on a track towards a hopefully tenure track position at that place that you do your fellowship. Slightly different from the integrated research pathway, which gives you in a certain number of months. At my program, it's 6 months of protected research time for you to do research during residency, and you have no clinical responsibilities. So that is the more popular route to go. That's the route that I'm on, and that will allow me to get into a project, to be substantive in my work in that project during the residency years, and then hopefully allowing that to be something that I then turn into a fellowship-based project, whether that stays, is me staying at Stanford or not, I can make that decision. And I like that pathway in the fact that you aren't marrying yourself to something so quickly, and it still provides you an opportunity to get mentorship at your residency space as well as potentially at your fellowship place, which may be different, and you're further widening your net of exposure experiences and, you know, hopefully adding a little bit more diversity to your training. So, but these are the pathways in pediatrics. There are some similarities to internal medicine. They also have an accelerated pathway. But because, of course, since their program is a four-year residency, they have, you know, a little bit more time to make their decisions. But their American Board of Internal Medicine have a research pathway, like this, the short track. And this is something that's particularly for students who have had a PhD, but it's certainly not exclusive to those individuals. So someone, I know Martha mentioned before, like, do you have to do a PhD? Like, this is one of those opportunities where you could get into a fellowship sooner and, you know, kind of more focus your research at that point, further, I guess, cultivating your, you know, your research prowess, learning more skills. And that's definitely a appealing path for many as well. And for the non-PhD, a lot of these places actually will have a opportunity for you to take formal graduate training if you're on the fast track. So that will kind of hopefully give you those skills that you may not have acquired if you do not have a formal graduate training prior to. So, but again, that's what I was trying to mention. There's many ways to skin a cat. And these research track programs try to make it to where it's still appealing. You're shaving off time to get closer into your, or sooner into your career, because otherwise, yes, it becomes such a deterrent for many people when they look at it systematically, how long it might take before you can actually do what you want to do as a physician scientist. So, and that was a major point for why I chose Stanford. They had these two programs that our board provides, and plus they have like a third option, which is basically you make it up yourself and you finish whenever you do, but you have a lot of flexibility and resources are never a question for them. Funding is not a question for them, and they're just excited to be there to help you whatever path you want to go. So, you know, that was, to me, you know, a pitch that I could not refuse, because it just seemed so ideal for the physician scientist. But these are the things that I would recommend that for those who are interested in this, you look into. Places will say that they are interested in training you as a physician scientist, but when you go there, you know, it becomes more apparent on an interview or when you formally, like, talk to their leadership how serious they are. And if they are interested in the theory of having the physician scientist there, but they don't have anything in place to really help to nurture you, you know, they just say, you know, whatever you want to do, we'll figure it out. You know, if they don't have anything more formal for you than that, that would be a red flag in my opinion. And you'll be surprised at how many times you'll hear that red flag. So that's just one point of caution, I would say, for those who are getting closer towards making these decisions. You really want to make sure that they're putting their money where their mouth is and that their program is structured in a way that can support what they claim to be interested in cultivating.
That makes sense. Thank you for that, Dennis. I don't know if you have a little bit more time. There were two more questions that came in, if it's right with your schedule.
Go ahead.
All right, cool. So Kara might be coming with hers. I know Juan asked quickly again on the chat. And I'll read out loud. My interest in research stems primarily from my desire to use it to analyze current health policy, to see where improvements can be made and or propose new health policy to create a more equitable healthcare system, increasing healthcare for underserved communities. As of now, most of my research experience has been in the qualitative fields, and one was wondering how basic science research or how, like, basic research may be used to analyze and or present new data to create health policy that addresses health disparities and help propose new health policies addressing these issues. Kind of the correlation between basic research and health policies, it seems. And if we could just mute our phone again, just to make sure. A little bit of background. Thank you.
Okay.
Follow the question. Yeah.
So, okay, basically the question is kind of unifying those skill sets, the qualitative work she's been doing with her ultimate interest in kind of working on equity. It sounds like health equity and policy, potential changes. And, yeah, I mean, that's definitely on the horizon as well. Like, in this environment that we're in of a lot of healthcare reform, we are rethinking a lot of the existing processes that we go through. You know, we know that we have a very inefficient system. We have a system that has a lot of implicit biases and just ways of kind of continuing health disparities. So trying to find ways to approach that is definitely a huge field. So that's great that she's interested in it. Now, in terms of, like, how one can prepare themselves for entering that field, I think there are multiple approaches. I have a few friends who are kind of doing similar things. A couple of them actually have gone a formal route of actually going to law school. So I'm thinking in particular to MDJDs I know who have gone that route to understand the legalese aspect of a lot of the policies that are in place. So, you know, that's one thing one can do, but they also both are in ridiculous debt. So that's not something I say is for everyone, surely. In terms of what one can do, though, there are opportunities both at the med school level as well as at the residency training level. I know that at Stanford we do have a policy track for those who are interested in health legislation and policy, allowing that to be basically their scholarly work, where they will have elective protected time to be engaged in legislation. They get to go to the Capitol to, like, hear what is in committee and to kind of discuss what some of the issues are regarding the policies that are being proposed. And some of them even have the opportunity to, like, assist on those committees, kind of like as a, I don't know if it's like a liaison or sort of proxy or something, but, you know, so while that's at Stanford, I know that those type of opportunities exist other places. In terms of bringing that into a research interest, however, I think that that's one of those type of projects that is probably best housed under these CTSIs, these clinical translational science, you know, type of awards, because policy is a type of translation of the work. You know, it's kind of that T4 type of level, like T1 and T2 is, you know, kind of more basic science-y and kind of slightly to bench side, but eventually you get to a point of taking it beyond even the bedsides like policy. And I think that there are opportunities and even like startup funds that can be acquired, even as a med student. I was able to get a pilot award for a project I was doing through our CTSA. So, you know, that's something I would say for her to look into. But again, for further cultivating those skills, it's so new that there are so many ways, I think, to kind of approach it. You know, coming from a legal way, trying to, again, maybe not even getting a full JD, but maybe take some classes within that. There's, of course, the Masters in Public Policy, the MPP, that provides some opportunities to, like, kind of build that skill set as well. There are, like I said, within many residency programs, policy type of, you know, tracks or electives or concentrations you can take. And if that's an interest of hers, that would be something specifically to look for in a program and something to ask about specifically in the obligatory, do you have any questions for us, question you'll get on your interview. So, you know, there I don't think is one good answer for, you know, how she can accomplish that. But I think that she just has to be thoughtful, think about what it is she's trying to do with it, and then, you know, consider many of these options that I just mentioned.
Thank you very much, Dennis, and thank you, Juan, for the question. And that was Juan. And it looks like Cara had a question. Hold on, I don't know if the audio is working.
Hi, my name is Cara Monroe. I'm a student at Loma Linda University School of Medicine. Thank you so
California.
Much for
this form. Go ahead. Say California, yay.
Yay, California. I have an interest in public health, especially epidemiology, and from your standpoint, what do you know about, I guess, the interest of having physician scientists in this area? What can I do to find residencies that will kind of foster that interest? And just going forward, what should I look for, and maybe what kind of candidate should I be, and what type of research should I be looking for or to look to get into?
Okay, so you were a little, there was a little echoey there for me, but you said that you have an interest in epidemiology.
Mm-hmm.
And your interest, within that, you're wondering, I guess, what the field's readiness is for having the physician scientist involved in that field, you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, there are many physicians who are in the epidemiology space, and, I was mentioning a little earlier that I find that to be the space that a lot of the persons with a public health background often find themselves going into. And it's, and again, large part because that is such a major component of public health graduate programs, less so than what you get in a formal, like, basic science PhD program. Mm-hmm. So I do think that if you're looking for ways to kind of bolster your, I guess, your skill set within that, you know, seeing what type of courses you can maybe take within a public health program, like a public health school, would be one thing. Now, again, a lot of these things, well, it depends on where you are. Some places will allow you to audit this, so it's not going to hopefully be to your financial detriment that you can learn about these skills. But then other times, it might be something that is worth you putting up the credit hours to you know, make sure that you get a better footing on that, because that is the foundation to getting an epidemiological type of career. You know, I mean, it's a lot more than just the, you know, do you understand what power is, and, you know, number needed to treat or something. So, I mean, having a good foundation in that is really what would serve you, just looking at the long run. Now, in terms of, like, what programs, like, in residency you want to look into, you want to make sure you go to a residency program that is at an institution with a strong public health component. These are typically the places that have a school of public health on the site. Not always, though, but, again, that's often a good indication that there's a lot of scholars around that you can kind of tap into their collective brain power, and then finding the mentorship that can maybe help you with whatever skill sets you may not have fully, you know, solidified prior to entering into a residency program. So these would be the things that I would say you would look forward to. And there are certainly many programs out there like that. Specifically, actually, I'm more familiar with on the East Coast. I know that Columbia has a lot of opportunities within that. Definitely Hopkins has a whole lot of opportunities within cultivating the public health interests and the epidemiological research interests of their residents. University of Wisconsin at Madison, their School of Public Health and Medicine is has that opportunity for their residents. So these are things to, you know, look. But in general, you know, if a school, if a place has a strong public health background already, obviously those would be the places you want to further look at for residency. But, no, there's a lot of room in that space for the physician. So certainly, you know, you gotta just find your niche and try to get those skills to get you in there.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, everybody. Are there any other questions before we close? All right. If not, from my end, on behalf of both SNMA and APSA, I want to thank you very much, Dennis, for your time. I think it was really appreciated. We had a lot of great questions. And thank you very much to everyone who joined the call. We had a very strong number of people who are on the call, and great questions, great conversation that we're able to have, and I look forward
to want to mention one more thing, actually.
Absolutely.
And again, thank you very much, Io and Peter, as well, for, you know, the invitation and also just having this collaboration. I think this is an awesome thing. So I'm really tipping my hat off to you two and all the others who are helping in the effort. I do want to also just mention that the, you know, the information I come with that I've been stating here, you know, has largely been not only just from my own experience, but from my own exposure in being a part of organizations like SNMA. I've attended APSA events in the past, but also NMA, NHMA, LMSA. You know, I've done a lot of work with many of these organizations, and, you know, we were talking about before what one can get out of leadership positions and involvement, but hopefully you aren't worse for wear, basically, from having done a lot of the work that you guys are all collectively doing. You want to make sure that you're gaining things from these exposures, experiences as well. There's been times I know that I've worked so hard on an event at a conference, and I've not been able to go to any workshops. So that's not what you want to find yourself, because you want to make sure that you are also benefiting, so that you can then hopefully be able to be a resource for someone else. Because again, a lot of these questions likely stem from the fact that a lot of information doesn't seem to just be at our fingertips for these career paths that we're supposed to be making decisions on, and they are not things that are really explicitly stated in med school. And that, you know, maybe an issue of just how our curriculums and everything are set up, but there's a lot that's out there that is just unfortunately not being communicated, but the information's out there. And that actually is one of the large reasons why we have started the Building the Next Generation of Academic Physicians, NGAP. And my last plug for that would be that I would ask for those who are not a part of our organization, it's not an organization you pay for, but it's not connected with our organization, that you check us out. It's bngap.org. That's B-N-G-A-P.org. and you can just sign up for free and hopefully be included in our mailings as we talk about our workshops, our webinars, where we talk about an academic medicine career path, because again, we're trying to build the next generation, and we talk in general about the fact about the career path, but also we do talk in specifics about bringing your service to scholarship, about taking your interest as a teaching, as in teaching towards entering an education track, tenure, you know, track within residency, right after residency, and towards early years of in your professional careers, early career, I guess, hirings. Because again, a lot of these things you won't learn in residency either, yet you're supposed to make a career decision. So we're trying to fill in that niche. We're trying to fill in that space so that we can provide people information, because you can't be upset with someone for not knowing what they don't know. So just wanted to put that little spiel there, thengap.org. And again, thanks again for the invitation.